high, you say you're gonna leave. You know what you like, 'cause that'll be the day when I die. When you give me all your love.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Jeff Bossert, sitting in for Celeste Quinn, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frayne. Today's guest on the program, Richie Unterberger, a music writer who's contributed heavily to publications like Rolling Stone and Record Collector. He's also been a writer of the liner notes of some CD reissues. His books include Turn, 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 The History of Folk Rock Through Mid-1966, The Rough Guide to Music USA, and Unknown Legends of Rock and Roll. He's also a heavy contributor to the online All Music Guide. But today we'll be talking solely about the Beatles in Richie Unterberger's book, The Unreleased Beatles, Music and Film. Hello, Richie Unterberger.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on the program. We just heard a recording by the Beatles as the Quarrymen, a very early recording. What has been released, your book is called The Unreleased Beatles, but of course the handful of tunes that have been released that you can actually buy in most stores are the Beatles anthology CDs as well as the Live at the BBC recordings, so we'll go through a few of those today. Why do this book? It seems like a dumb question, but I've seen that in some other interviews. How did you go about discovering that this angle has never been taken before in writing about the Beatles?
I was approached by the publisher to write a book about the Beatles, and like a lot of Beatles fans, my first reaction was, well, what exactly can I write, even though I'm a big expert on them and they're my favorite group, because there are several hundred books about the Beatles and more coming out all the time. But only about half a minute later, I thought, well, I could do one book that has a very kind of esoteric angle, a whole book only about their unreleased recordings. And the publisher said yes, and that was a little over 2 years ago. Now the book is out. Now some people might be thinking, how can you make a whole book out of that, especially because the anthology CDs and the Live with the BBC compilation has 8 CDs of previously unreleased material, which came out about 10 years ago. And the book is 400 pages and 300,000 words. So there is a vast quantity of material by the Beatles that has still not been released. I also cover unreleased film footage of them. I mean, film that's been viewed but has not been issued on commercial video or DVD. And there's more coming out all the time. It's kind of almost creepy, but magical too, I think.
Yeah, the only other access that we have to any of this material is through bootleg recordings. And you apparently have had access to quite a bit of this material and thus led to the book.
Yeah, and I've been collecting rare Beatles stuff for about 35 years. And in fact, in the introduction to the book, I tell the story of how I found my first Beatles bootleg. It's something you couldn't make up. I was 8 years old, and it was the spring of 1970. And the Beatles were still a functioning group as far as we knew. And I was entitled to a present, and I wanted to get a Beatles album. I only had one album in my collection, which was a Beatles album. I wanted a second one. We went to a store with my mother, and the clerk said, well, we have the new Beatles album, and she pointed out this blank white sleeve. And even then, it was very mysterious to me. I mean, what do you mean? It's not the white album. It's some record I've never seen before. But I took a chance, and what it was an album called Comeback, which had unreleased material from what were then known as the Get Back sessions, but that which became known as the Let It Be sessions, and the Let It Be album is drawn from there. I took it home, and it was obvious to me that I had never heard these songs on the radio. Even the songs I had heard, like Let It Be and Get Back, they were totally different versions. I thought, this is really cool. I must be one of the only people in the world who's hearing this stuff. Little did I know that probably about 100,000 other people already had it by then, because that was one of the very, very first popular rock bootlegs. A few weeks later, of course, the Beatles broke up. A few weeks after that, the Let It Be album came out with all these yet different versions. Even then, I could tell that they were totally different from what I had in my bootleg. And since then, I've been collecting all that I could. I never imagined that this much stuff would surface. And in a sense, when I was approached to do a book and we came up with this idea, I had already been preparing for it for 35 years.
Now, this first recording we heard were John, Paul, George, and I think a couple of friends of theirs that helped fill in the Percy Phillips Electric Shop recording of That'll Be the Day.
Yeah, and that is on Anthology 1. And even though there's one recording before that of John singing with the Quarrymen, the group that evolved into the Beatles, it's what has been circulating is of really, really terrible quality. It's just half a minute of a skiffle song, and Paul is not even in the group. As it happens, that recording is from the day that John Lennon met Paul McCartney. But the fragment we just heard of Buddy Holly's That'll Be the Day, John, Paul, and George went into, you know, pretty much a vanity studio in Liverpool to record it, kind of like just as a souvenir for themselves. And there were other guys who were in the Quarrymen at the time helping them out, although they didn't stay with the group for much longer. This is mid-1958 we're talking about when they recorded That'll Be the Day. And, you know, bear in mind that they're teenagers, so they don't sound that much like the Beatles, and they don't sound anywhere near as professional as even the earliest Beatles official records were, but they sound pretty good for teenagers there, I think.
We're talking with Richie Unterberger about his book, The Unreleased Beatles, Music and Film. We welcome your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Perhaps you want to know about a song that the Beatles were rumored to have recorded that you don't have, or maybe a recording that you want to know more about. We welcome your questions for Mr. Unterberger. You mentioned early in the book that there was a stretch of music early in the early late 50s, early 60s that they did that isn't available anywhere, even on bootlegs, that really doesn't it doesn't fully explain in that stretch how they transformed so quickly into, you know, became the most greatest and popular groups ever.
Yeah, there are quite a few recordings from probably around spring 1960. They probably made it at their home or in some basement or somewhere. The fidelity is pretty poor. And some tracks from those tapes are on the first volume of Anthology. And to be blunt, I mean, it sounds really cool. Oh, there's an hour or two of the Beatles in early 1960. That must sound really fascinating. They sound terrible. It's really a shock. Even to huge Beatles fans such as myself, you have to admit, they don't sound good. They have a hard time playing in tune and in time. Paul's singing, at least, is fairly good, but they really are making a terrible racket. Now, between that point and January 1st, 1962, there are no recordings of the Beatles. There are some that are rumored to exist, but they probably don't. The only recordings that do exist are of sessions from 1961 where they backed a singer called Tony Sheridan in Hamburg, and they do a couple of songs of their own on those recordings, which have been officially issued and have been available for a long time. But those recordings with Tony Sheridan aren't too representative of how the Beatles sounded by themselves. So from the time when you hear them sounding worse than the average garage band today in early 1960 to January 1st, 1962, when they did an audition tape for Decca Records with 15 songs in very good quality where they are starting to sound like the Beatles, we don't know exactly how they got from A to B in about a year and a half so quickly. And furthermore, from that Decca audition tape to their first album in early 1963 is another huge leap where they almost sound like a different group, except that their voices are obviously the same. But there are so many unreleased recordings from 1962 that we can actually follow that progression pretty well. For one thing, Pete Best is on that Decca audition tape from January 1st, 1962. He was replaced by Ringo Starr, of course, in August 1962. There are some rehearsal tapes and live tapes from the Cavern where they sound very exciting. Of course, there are those Hamburg tapes from late 1962 where Ringo was in the band. The quality's not very good, but you get a good sense of how they played live and how many different songs they covered before they really started to emphasize Lennon-McCartney songs.
We've got a caller on the line, on line four in Verinum. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. You do know this is Beatle Day. I just came up with this yesterday. I want to make this day a national holiday, and it's the anniversary of the Ed Sullivan appearance. I just read an article recently that George spent 3 weeks in Benton, Illinois in the weeks before the first appearance in 64. And my film question here is, I went to a couple of different video stores trying to find Let It Be for sale. I couldn't find. They just wasn't available for sale. Also, I want to recommend a film and ask you if you know if this is available. A film called First Visit about the first American appearance of the Beatles. Yay, Beatles. Thanks a lot.
Okay. I think I've been asked more questions about the Let It Be film and why it's not available than I have almost any other topic that I cover in the book. It's very mysterious to me. The Let It Be film is not available officially on DVD. And what the Beatles could be doing, I think, is not only reissuing the film itself, but they were filmed so often during that month that I think it would be fairly easy to come up with an hour or two of extra footage that no one's ever seen. That would be very interesting. And there's a huge waiting market for that film. I don't have an answer as to why there's such a delay getting it onto DVD. And I also want to mention about that time when Let It Be was filmed. That was January 1969. And the reason that there are so many unreleased Beatles recordings just from that month is that they were being filmed every day, like 20 days out of that month. And the cameras were running the whole time when they were rehearsing and getting the arrangements together for the material. There are 80 CDs, not 18, 80 CDs of unreleased Beatles material just from that month, about 100 hours worth. And that's probably by far the most concentrated dose of unreleased Beatles out there. As far as the first U.S. Visits film, I believe that is still available on DVD. If you can't find it at a rental store, go online. And basically, when they came to New York and Washington, D.C. on their first American visit as a group in February 64, they were being filmed by the Maysles brothers, the famous documentarians. And this DVD was assembled from that footage. And even though it's a little raw, it's not, you know, the most coherent documentary, it's very interesting because you get to a sense of the real mayhem and hysteria that greeted the Beatles from the moment they landed in the airport in New York City and the next week or so when they were doing their first couple of concerts here and appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Let's listen to something else. I believe this is also officially released on Beatles Anthology 1, and I believe part of the audition. They'd gone to Decca Records and failed that, also auditioned, played for the BBC, and then when they auditioned for George Martin, here's a take of Love Me Do. And I think I was correct in that recording. Can you tell us a bit more about that one?
Yeah, that was from June 1962. And what we're hearing are the Beatles auditioning for EMI Records. They had auditioned for Decca Records in January of 62 with Pete Best still on drums, and they had failed that audition. But George Martin called them in after much nagging from Brian Epstein, their manager, and only two songs have been found from whatever they taped at that audition. There's the version of Love Me Do we just heard a little bit of, and also Besame Mucho. And Pete Best was still on drums. Even on that cut, the drumming's not that great. Now, even though the version of Love Me Do that they're doing is pretty similar to the one on the single, the Beatles do sound pretty nervous, understandably, because it was an audition for one of the only four big records, big record labels in Britain at that time. But Pete Best doesn't sound that good, and if you continue with that track on your own, those of you who have the anthology, they almost lose the beat at one point. And George Martin did say to the group, I want to record with you, but we'll have to do it with a session drummer, because that kind of drumming that your drummer has isn't what I want on the records. And that was apparently one of the last straws and something that they had been thinking about for a while, which was deciding to replace Pete Best with Ringo Starr. I think that was unquestionably the best decision that the Beatles ever made, because not only was Ringo a better drummer, but he fit in with the band much better as a personality. And you can hear a lot more of Pete Best drumming on that Decca audition tape. And he doesn't sound that good there either, but the Beatles as a whole don't sound nearly as good as they would a year after that. So it's quite fascinating listening, that 15-song tape for Decca.
Another thing that that George Martin had talked about, and you mentioned in the book, was that he partially signed them based the four of them based on their charm and things that came through, and he saw that as part and that chemistry as part of the their appeal and marketing the band.
Yeah, he said that on several occasions, and when you listen to what we can hear of the audition tape that they did for George Martin, you know, you can hear that there's promise, but it doesn't sound nearly as good as what the Beatles were coming up with very quickly after that. They didn't have most of the original songs written that they did even in 1963. And what George Martin has said is that, well, ordinarily maybe he wouldn't have been so impressed, but the Beatles made him and the rest of the EMI staff laugh so much and entertain them so much that they thought, you know, whatever music these guys are making, something has to happen here because they're so charismatic. Now, luckily for everybody involved, they turned out to be great musicians and great songwriters, too. But even at that point, they were really saying that about John, Paul, and George. They weren't saying that about Pete Best, who, as they remember, barely said anything during the whole audition because he was so shy. So, again, I think that's an indicator that the Beatles were right, as cruel maybe as the decision was in some respects, to replace Pete Best with Ringo right before they did their first single, Love Me Do.
Another one I'd like to play off Anthology 1, getting through this portion of the Beatles' progression as artists, is a take of I'll Be Back that broke down quickly because they tried doing it in 3/4 time, and as John indicates, it was too hard to sing.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, you know, if you break my heart, I'll go, but I'll be back again, 'cause I told you once before goodbye, but I came back again, I love you so, I'm the one who wants you, yes, I'm the one who wants you.
I think that track points out to the experimentation that the Beatles would do with a lot of songs. Let's try this in different times. Let's try different instrumentations, etc.
Yeah, and one of the pleasures of hearing the unreleased Beatles music is that you get a lot of insight, I think, into their creative process as songwriters and musicians, and it also comes through what perfectionists they were. Because sometimes they would get an arrangement or a take to a state where almost any other band or producer would say, this is pretty good. We don't have to work on it anymore. But they could hear refinements in their heads, and they would work like dogs over the period of days sometimes to get the song into the shape that they wanted. For instance, there is a whole CD of different versions of Strawberry Fields Forever from the time that John was playing it as an acoustic guitar demo for himself until the final studio version. And they just kept remaking and remaking and trying different things and different splices. And it wasn't indulgence. It was really necessary to get the song to where they wanted. I think another pleasure of listening to the Beatles' unreleased material is that the sense of humor comes through so well, even when they're kind of messing up, as they were on that take. And there are many more alternate versions where they're working on things that have not come out on Anthology or anything else. And even when they're kind of upset with each other or themselves, their sense of humor is always present. And it's like kind of listening to sharing inside jokes with your family, because a lot of listeners who grew up with the Beatles, they almost think of them as unofficial brothers, both among themselves and to us. So even though it's a little voyeuristic, you're kind of getting a peek at something you maybe weren't supposed to, you also kind of feel like it's okay that you're sharing it with people that you know very well, or at least as well as you know anybody who you haven't met in person.
I want to talk about BBC recordings. Much of your book early talked about auditioning for them, but then just several sections. And there have to be many hours. While the Live at the BBC two CD set is nice, there's got to be a whole lot more that has never seen the light of day, except for those who have bootleg recordings.
Live at the BBC compilation has two CDs, and I do think that for the most part, the tracks they selected were very intelligently chosen because they emphasized the songs that they did for the BBC, which they never put on their records, most of those songs being covers of American rock and roll classics. But there are actually about 10 CDs worth of material that the Beatles recorded for the BBC between 1962 and 1965. They did 40 sessions in 1963 alone. That's how popular they were and how hard they worked at promoting themselves. And you might be thinking to yourself, why do I need 10 versions of Twist and Shout, 3 of She's a Woman, 5 of I Saw Her Standing There, and whatever. But if you are a very serious Beatles fan, and if that's only 10% of Beatles fans, that's still millions of people, it's really entertaining to hear how they would vary the arrangement from live performance to live performance sometimes, and how even when they were repeating a popular song over and over, like She Loves You or something, the enthusiasm, it was never less than 100%. And hearing them live, because essentially they were recording live in the studio, as opposed to the recorded version, which we've probably heard hundreds of times, it makes the song itself, I think, sound a lot fresher than it would be just going back to the familiar version from the Beatles album. Something else I wanted to mention was that there have been other books, real specialist books, about the Beatles' unreleased material, and I respect a lot of the research that's going into that, but what I tried to do with this book is to write it as something that would be fun to read and concentrate on the music, not just on how rare something is and why some version might differ from the other. That's important information that's in there, but I also wanted to draw out what all this unreleased music tells us about how the Beatles' music evolved and how they worked among themselves and how they wrote their material, and make it a book that's fun to read, just as it's fun to listen to the actual material.
You mentioned live material, and one has a picture in their head of you know, a lot of screaming and mayhem. And how many live recordings outside of, you know, concerts are actual music that you can comprehend, or is it, you know, shoddy recording that that's hard to pick up what's going on?
It's a little surprising. I mean, from the peak years of Beatlemania, which I would say would go from late 1963 to mid-66 when they stopped touring, there are about a dozen shows available in full or almost full length that are pretty listenable. Some of them are in sound quality that's almost good as the Hollywood Bowl material that actually came out as an official album in 1977.
But never released on CD.
Never released on CD, a big mystery. And a lot of people don't know that the Beatles were actually recorded for 3 different concerts at the Hollywood Bowl, one in 1964 and two in 1965. The official album that was released was drawn from all of those. I think what they should do is not only release that on CD officially, but make it kind of a deluxe edition. Put all 3 concerts on there in total, even though you'll hear some of the same songs 2 times or 3 times in different versions. The quality is pretty good, at least for that era. And as a historical document, it's really vital.
Tell me about their Christmas songs, the only one that we've been able to get a hold of, and let me find some underground recordings, is Christmas Time is Here Again, and apparently an edited version of a really simple song. And they were made available as part of a fan club.
Yeah, in In Britain in 1963, the Beatles' popularity became so big within a year after they recorded that they decided to do a special Christmas fan club disc. And every year between 1963 and 1969, for Christmas, if you were a part of the fan club, you would get a Flexi with a track that was about 5 minutes long of the Beatles. Now, that sounds really exciting because you might think, oh, these are songs I've never heard before, and only people who were with a fan club had those records. I'd love to hear those. Well, it's maybe not as exciting as you might think in that way, because it didn't have, like, unreleased Lennon, McCartney, and Harrison songs. It was basically the Beatles fooling around the studio, making jokes, singing some real corny old Christmas songs, and doing sketches. It's still really entertaining because you get a good sense of the Beatles' humor, even though it's a kind of a scripted humor. But there aren't complete songs. There aren't even different versions of famous songs that they did. But what's interesting when you hear all seven of those discs in a row is that the music, even on those Christmas discs, changes enormously between 1963 and 1969, just like the Beatles' albums changed enormously. Because when the first Christmas disc came out, basically it was like, oh, hello to all fans. Thank you for buying our records. We love you, just like entertainers were pretty much expected to do in those days. By 1968 and 1969, they were really weird psychedelic collages, and Yoko Ono appears in the last couple of them. It's a reflection of how the Beatles themselves grew, even in their humor and the way they approached these professional obligations.
Let's move ahead a little bit musically. I think my favorite album is probably Revolver, or maybe with Rubber Soul, maybe a close second. And an early cut of And Your Bird Can Sing. This is off Anthology 2.
One, two, three, four. You tell me that you've got everything you want, and your bird can sing, but you don't get me. You don't get me. You sing seven wonders, and your bird is queen, but you don't see me. You can't see me. When your prizes start to wane.
Well, that one fell apart quickly for the four of them. Again, I guess another example of their humor, but an example of something that ended up sounding a lot different when Revolver came out.
Yeah, the version that we hear on that recording, it sounds a lot more like the Birds than the version that's on Revolver. And as far as those vocal overdubs where they're really giggling, I mean, we're never going to know. It sounds like they might have been smoking something outside before they went in the vocal booth to do that. Interestingly, some bootleggers have manufactured a different version where by taking the signals of the stereo mix out of phase with each other, they can isolate those parts of the vocal out. In other words, they've manufactured a version that's exactly the same except you don't hear any of that giggling. So if you just want to hear it as a straightforward alternate take, that sounds a lot more like the birds, that has been kind of artificially manufactured. But whether you hear it without the giggles or with the giggles, it's a good example of two things: how they would sometimes substantially change an arrangement, even though what they had sounds pretty good, and also the fun that they had in the studio, because I think certainly until the very end of the Beatles' career, part of what made the music so great was that they really were really good friends. And those interpersonal connections really bled through to the music, and that's why we're so happy listening to it even 35, 40 years later. Of course, at the very end, a lot of rancor seeped in, and Paul ended up suing the other three Beatles at the end of 1970. It was an unfortunate end for people who had been so close, but for most of their career, certainly, it was an overriding factor in what was making the music click so heavily.
You mentioned what bootleggers have done. A colleague at work showed me Beatles mashups. You go to YouTube.com and you can hear a lot of different versions of songs and Beatles even mixed with other artists.
Yeah, and that's kind of a subgenre of Beatles bootlegging that I did not cover in the book because I wanted to concentrate on the Beatles music, not the mashups. There were a couple instances where I mentioned, like, doctored takes because they were interesting, one being the one we just talked about, Anya Burr Can Sing, another where someone reconstructed a full take, a full alternate take of You Know My Name. But something that's interesting to point out about those so-called mashups, I think, the, quote, new Beatles album, Love, it's kind of a mashup that happens to have been overseen by George Martin and his son. And they have said in interviews that they kind of took some cues by what people were doing on the sly by artificially doctoring or editing or overlaying Beatles tracks on their own. And there are probably infinite variations of those that are done at home these days. But that was an example of the bootlicking culture actually influencing a very official mainstream release.
I wasn't aware of that. I knew that it was done for Love was done for a Cirque du Soleil show, but didn't know it. I only knew that George and his son had gone back in the studio with the original master tapes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the original premise was to provide a soundtrack for Cirque du Soleil, which has been playing over, you know, it started playing last year in Las Vegas, but then the idea became the soundtrack that we've created for Cirque du Soleil, we can make it into a proper record. Now, the record itself of Love does not use many previously unreleased Beatles recordings, and what previously unreleased Beatles recordings are used are woven into a track with a bunch of other elements of released recordings. So it's not like getting some Beatles outtakes. It's kind of a whole different thing. It's almost a 21st century way of looking at taking old material and refashioning it for today's marketplace, I guess.
You know, another interesting thing you brought up in the book was there are a lot of songs, or even small parts of songs, a guitar lick, something like that, that would be done 1 year, and then maybe 3-4 years later, they actually finish the song. I mean, the Beatles, I know when they rehearsed the Get Back, or later known as the Let It Be sessions, they played George's All Things Must Pass and a couple other songs that ended up being released solo by the Beatles later on.
Yeah, and you can find examples of this going back very early into the Beatles' career. John Lennon did some home tapes of If I Fell, in probably around early 1964, just him and an acoustic guitar. And in one of those early versions, he sings a wordless hook. He's just kind of la-la-ing. I'm not going to try and sing it to you. But what he sings is very close to the wordless singing he does in Imagine, and that's 7 years later. So he hung on to that idea for all those years. Another example is there's a tape of Paul McCartney doing a classical composition called Bure, and he would use that approach in two songs subsequently for Michelle and Blackbird. And certainly, as you point out, during the sessions they did in January 1969 when they were filming Let It Be, they considered a bunch of songs that they didn't really finish for official studio release, but which turned up on their solo albums. A few George Harrison songs, like All Things Must Pass and Let It Down, and others that ended up on his first album, All Things Must Pass. Basically, he had written so many songs at that point, and John and Paul weren't giving him much room on Beatles records. They were only giving him a couple songs per record, pretty much. Per disc, I should say, because they gave him four for the White Album, which was a double album. And he had no other way to get them out but to do it on his own, which he did right after the Beatles broke up, of course. But you can also hear some Paul McCartney songs that didn't come out until Ram. You can hear a couple of John Lennon songs that didn't come out until Imagine. And one of those, Child of Nature, the Beatles had done as a White Album demo back in May 1968. And John kept the tune but totally changed the lyrics to refer to Yoko, and that tune became Jealous Guy with totally different lyrics.
We got just about 10 minutes left, a little under that. 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you'd like to ask a question of Richie Unterberger. We're discussing his book, The Unreleased Beatles. Let's play something else. This is A Day in the Life. We're going to go through a little bit of this. This is an early cut take of this song and not nearly the instrumentation it wound up with.
Sugar Bum Fairy, Sugar Bum Fairy.
And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed.
For time purposes, we'll cut it off there, but I know part of that track later on, you'll hear Mal Evans, the roadie, counting out the measures at where the strings will end up playing in the final recording.
Yeah, and it's another example of a song that structurally it's pretty much finished. John would change his vocal a little bit, and they would add Ringo's dramatic drums, but a lot of the arrangement is there, but again, especially during this era, which is when they were producing Sgt. Pepper, the Beatles could hear things in their heads that not only hadn't been done on the takes they were working on yet, but hadn't really been done by anybody. And as you mentioned, their roadie counted off in the instrumental section where on the record you hear this dramatic orchestral crescendo, kind of simulating a rush. A lot of people at the time said it was like a drug-like rush, but also just kind of simulating some sort of disaster that was on the way. And that's where George Martin, I think, was a vital asset to the group, especially at this time. He was a big asset to the group for their whole career. But at this time, when they had an idea for something, but they didn't play the instruments themselves, or they weren't quite sure how it could be captured on tape with the technology they had, he was a vital kind of translator of those ideas from John Lennon or Paul McCartney's head to what we hear on the tape, on the finished record.
We've got a caller on the line, line four from Mattoon. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I've just been listening. This has been a great interview, and the book sounds really fascinating. What I'm wondering, though, is can you suggest anything that people can get that would, you know, give you an idea? I mean, how do you get these so-called unreleased recordings that are now available, and what do you look for, and do you have any that you would suggest?
The publisher and I had to state in the introduction to the book that we couldn't correspond with readers as to how to obtain these recordings. That's just something we felt that we had to do. But if you're able to find these, and historically, since 1970, bootlegs can be found in many places. That's all I can say about it. But if you're looking for the best material, I mean, there's tons. But some of the most interesting batches, I would say, would be their White Album demos from May 1968, where they assembled at George Harrison's house and did very acoustic-oriented versions of a lot of songs that would end up on the White Album, and also some songs that would not. Some of those tracks are on the third volume of Anthology, but most of them are not. Also, the 15-song Decca tape that I mentioned earlier, that's not the best Beatles music, but it's essentially their first album in that it gives you a very good sense of the material they were playing by people like Buddy Holly and even Bobby V, and how they sounded with Pete Best on drums, and the very first Lennon-McCartney originals that they were playing live. And I think also, if you're able to find some live material from the Beatles during the Beatlemania years, there's a Philadelphia show from 1964 that's very fun and sounds almost as good as Hollywood Bowl. There is a 1965 show from Houston, which is some pretty good quality. And they sound a little more relaxed and at ease than they do in the Hollywood Bowl tapes, because I think for the Hollywood Bowl tapes, they knew they were being recorded by Capitol and inhibited them a little. Also, if you really like what you hear in the BBC sessions from the Life of the BBC compilation, there's a lot of other good stuff and good quality. The thing is, there are a lot of multiple versions of the same song. But if you can put up with that, I think those are the most fun unreleased Beatles recordings, because they sound great as a band. They're doing, even when they're doing familiar songs, it's not the exact same version. And the sound quality is usually pretty good.
You mentioned one earlier in the conversation where you said it had never been released on CD, and I didn't jot down the name, but the way that you two discussed it, it sounded like maybe it had been released on vinyl or in some other format.
Yeah, you're thinking of the Beatles Live at the Hollywood Bowl,
uh-huh.
which did come out officially in 1977. Not only that, I mean, it was a huge selling record. It went to the top of the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mystery as to why that is not officially available on CD and never has been. It's very easy to find as a used record in good condition. You can probably find it for $5.
Okay.
But, of course, fans would like to have it on CD. And my suggestion, not that anyone has asked me who administers the Beatles catalog, but my suggestion would be, if they're going to put out on CD, make all three shows available on that CD package, not just the 13 songs from those three shows that they put on the LP back in 1977. But, I mean, the sound quality on the Hollywood Bowl LP, it's pretty good, and it's definitely a good representation of both what they sounded like on stage in the mid-1960s and the sheer level of hysteria by the fans. I mean, even on this recording that was remastered with the best available 1977 technology, George Martin even says in his liner notes from the back, it was like trying to record a group in the middle of jets taking off. That's how, you know, maniacal the fans were.
Also, just quickly, I have a copy of the White Album. I think it was the second pressing because the name The Beatles has been gone over with gray instead of just being raised, but it's still raised. And it still has the original poster and the original 4x10 photos that came with it. Is that the fairly valuable commodity I want to hang on to?
Well, I think so because, you know, in the CD era, you can't get those, you know, very big pictures of each four individual mm-hmm. Beatles in that poster, which everybody was hanging up. I mean, even though I was 6 years old when the album came out, I remember everybody hung it up on their walls. And as far as the value of it, if your vinyl is in good condition...
Mint.
Oh.
I got it as a sealed album, and I've never played it.
I see.
It's my second copy of that album.
It's valuable, but maybe not as valuable as you think. I'm not a huge expert on the values of different pressings. I would say, you know, maybe $30 to $50. But the most valuable pressings of the White Album are the very, very early ones, mm-hmm. which unfortunately you don't have. And also, like, the lower the number, it sounds kind of strange, but the lower the number, the more valuable it is. But you really have to get into numbers, you know, because I should explain. They stamped every copy with an individual number going into the millions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get a copy that's 100 or below, those are the very first to have rolled off the line. And those are quite valuable, especially the, you know, like number one and number two, because those went to the Beatles. And they sell for like $10,000 or something like that. But it's very unlikely that if anybody bought it in the store, certainly in the United States, that you'd have anything that had a number that was that low.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot for the show. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thank you. One thing I want to ask you about before we run out of time, about current Beatles news, the settlement with Apple Computers and Apple Corps. Might we see, as a result of this, might this prompt maybe the Apple Corps to release some more of these old tapes and put them on CD?
I don't think that settlement itself would be an incitement. It's hard to gauge the interest of the Beatles in releasing their back catalog. They are kind of enigmatic about it because, you know, there are so many artists that will release everything that's possible to exploit commercially. Elvis Presley's catalog, I mean, there must be hundreds of records by now. The Beatles are much more selective. I think it has to do with a couple of things, and I actually have a chapter about this at the end of my book. One is that we have two surviving Beatles, one of whom is extremely headstrong, Paul McCartney, and two estates of the Beatles, one of whom is run by a very headstrong woman, Yoko Ono. I think with that much money at stake, it's kind of hard to agree on any project. But also, I think that the Beatles, and especially Paul, anything they put out, they want to be seen as an event, like the Love Album was, whatever you think of it. And putting out outtakes that, even though they might be kind of fun, you know, the quality might be a little fuzzy or the performances might be a little rawer than they want. First, they might be a little embarrassed. They shouldn't be, I think, but they might be a little embarrassed about the quality because they want it to be on par with their regular discography. And also, I think they might be concerned that the more things like this come out, the less successful they're going to be. They're not going to automatically sell into the top 10. They're not automatically going to sell a million units like all of their other projects have. I wish they would consider making this available because I think there is an enormous interest, and there's got to be at least half a dozen records like the White Album Demos and Hollywood Bowl that would sell really well and sound really good. But like I said, they haven't gotten me on the line and asked me my opinion yet.
Well, we're going to have to wrap this up. I wish we could do this for a bit longer and play some songs, but Richie Unterberger has been our guest on the Afternoon Magazine. His book is The Unreleased Beatles, Music and Film. It's published by Backbeat Books, and you also have a website, correct, RichieUnterberger.com?
Yes, and it has some excerpts of the book up there.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks. My pleasure.